This is Paula. Today I'm going to be reading a variety of articles for you from the Christian Science Monitor, dated Friday, February the 13th, 2026. Happy Valentine's Day. So, as is my custom in these, when we get together to look at what's in the monitor, we're going to start in the world section, and we're going to work our way through as many sections as we can in the time that we have. So, our first headline from today's world section of the monitor reads, Chloe Kim took silver in Olympic halfpipe, but she still kind of won. Chloe Kim finished second in Thursday's Olympic snowboarding halfpipe, but she helped gold medalist Choi Ga-on get to the top. The date on this article is February the 13th. It is by Story Hinckley, who is a staff writer at the Monitor. And the dateline is Livigno, Italy. NBC couldn't have scripted it any better. The floodlights, the falling snow, the spectators holding their breath as the student had one last chance to beat the master. After the first two runs at Thursday's 2026 Winter Olympic snowboard halfpipe final, it looked like American Chloe Kim had made history. No other female halfpipe snowboarder has two Olympic gold medals. Ms. Kim was going for three in a row, something no one has done, male or female. On a tough night that saw the best riders struggle to stay upright, the toughest fall came from Ms. Kim's toughest competition. 17-year-old South Korean phenom Choi Ga-on had grown up looking to Ms. Kim as an idol, but Ms. Choi had fallen so hard on her first run, they brought up a stretcher for her. After a long time, she ended up not needing it. Then, on her second run, she fell again. But there she was for the third run, limping before she dropped into the pipe before a hushed crowd. What followed was a spectacular run of flying flips. When the scores came, she had topped Ms. Kim by a little over 2 points. On Ms. Kim's final run, her last chance to overcome Ms. Choi, she fell, and South Korea had its first ever gold medal in snowboarding. In a way, however, it was not what Ms. Kim did on that last run Thursday that sealed the gold medal for Ms. Choi. It was what she did years ago off the halfpipe that set this extraordinary night in motion. Back in 2017, the two young women met at an Olympic test event in Pyeongchang, South Korea. Their fathers connected, leading Ms. Choi to train at Mammoth Mountain in California, where Ms. Kim grew up snowboarding. Ms. Kim, a second-generation Korean-American, said earlier this week that watching Ms. Choi has felt like seeing a mirror reflection of myself and my family. So, at the end of Ms. Kim's final run, dreams of a third straight gold medal officially dashed, there was still nothing but smiles, and then a big hug for her little protege. She is truly a force, and I'm so proud of her, and I'm so happy for her, said Ms. Kim. I always wanted to be there for her, and I still do. Although we are an individual sport, it means so much to me to know that I've inspired a whole new generation. Later, with a gold medal around her neck, Ms. Choi could only think of how strange it was to beat the woman she has looked up to for so long. Honestly, I wanted to win today, but I found myself subconsciously rooting for Chloe, too, she said. It felt a bit strange because she's such an idol to me, and I was cheering for both of us at the same time. Ms. Choi was probably not the only competitor in the field who could say the same. Ms. Kim's own teammate, B. Kim, no relation, said traveling to Pyeongchang in 2018 and watching Chloe win the gold was her start in the sport. Now, to be Chloe's teammate and friend feels like all of a sudden being friends with Michael Jordan and playing pickup with him, said Bia. It's a bit of a full circle moment, she said after finishing eighth. To get to call her a friend, a mentor, and a teammate, it's very special. She's given me so much in this sport. Chloe King has been the dominant force in women's halfpipe for the past decade. She became the youngest ever X Games title winner at age 14 and has 10 X Game medals from 10 appearances. She and American snowboarder Shaun White share the record for the most golds with 8 each. There are some who say she could have medaled at the 2014 Sochi Olympics, although at 13 she was too young to compete. Instead, she proceeded to become the youngest Olympic halfpipe gold medalist 4 years later in Pyeongchang. The youngest until now. Ms. Choi now takes the distinction by 7 months. Ms. Kim won gold again at the 2022 Beijing Games, but after an injury this January, it was not at all certain she would be ready to fly 20 feet above the halfpipe's 23-foot walls, pitched at 81 degrees. At a press conference after Thursday's event, Ms. Kim teared up with gratitude for completing her comeback and competing here. Success has brought perspective. As has been the sporting big sister to two of halfpipe's bright young stars. After all, Ms. Kim has been here before. One of B. Kim's favorite memories was the first time she landed on the podium in January 2024. Chloe fell that night too, finishing just off the podium, but B remembers the same big smile, the same warm embrace. She was super congratulatory toward me and the other girls and allowed us to have our moment to celebrate, B. Kim told Elle in December. That's definitely something that I would like to take into future events. The love has been mutual. After Thursday's halfpipe, Chloe admitted that the sport has grown stale. By pushing new limits, the next generation of young women brought back her inspiration. They inspired me to push my limits and try things I've never done before, she said. I just want to say to the field, thank you so much for giving me that opportunity. If they didn't push me, I wouldn't have seen how far I could go as a snowboarder. The future, she said, is in good hands with Ms. Choi. I'm so proud of her. It's all part of the sport. It's all about inspiring the next generation. It's all about passing the torch. And again, this particular article was by Story Hinckley, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Moving on to our second headline from today's World section of The Monitor, this one reads, "The Trump Effect May Test Appeal of Europe's Far-Right Parties. Portugal Shows How." The date on this article is February the 12th. It is by Ned Temko, who is a columnist at The Monitor, and the dateline is London. Portugal, at the southwestern tip of Europe, is perhaps best known to Americans as a delightful tourist destination. But this week, its voters delivered a message that has become increasingly rare, a full-throated rejection of one of Europe's rising far-right populist parties. Still, with Europe's populist surge unlikely to recede, the wider significance of Portugal's presidential election was to underscore a deepening divide between Europe and its traditional ally, America, over the continent's political future. This Trump factor has been a growing cause of concern for mainstream European leaders. But the Portuguese election result could reinforce their hope that Mr. Trump's polarizing effect will strengthen their hand and eventually slow the advance of the far right. The Trump administration, as its recent national security strategy made explicit, views the anti-immigration nationalists as, quote, patriotic forces to be supported in a struggle to prevent Europe's civilizational erasure. For Europe's mainstream politicians, they're a threat, and not chiefly because of their calls to limit immigration, which even left-of-center leaders increasingly recognize as an urgent issue. It's because of the anger underpinning their message, the suggestion that only a root and branch overhaul can keep established parties and national institutions from betraying their citizens' true interests and values. The center-right mayor of Portugal's capital, Lisbon, voiced this concern after Sunday's election. Carlos Moedas was among the conservative politicians who set aside partisan rivalries to support the socialist candidate António José Seguro in his runoff with André Ventura, the charismatic leader of the far-right Chega party. Mr. Seguro won nearly 67% of the vote. Yet, Mr. Ventura's one-third share established Chega as unchallenged leader of the country's conservatives, a position held for years by Mr. Modea's Social Democrats. And while Mr. Modea's welcomed the election as a demonstration that Portugal remained a moderate country, he told the New York Times that a big question remained, whether Europe's leaders could find a way to defuse the anger driving many far-right supporters. It's a worldwide trend, he said, and I hope we can stop it. The concerns he and many European leaders have about the effects of unbridled anger as well as the value they place on democratic stability are rooted in a pre-World War II history, which they feel Mr. Trump has failed to comprehend. The endangered, quote, civilization that Mr. Trump's national security strategy suggests patriotic populists can reclaim was in fact a period of power struggles and war, culminating in two devastating world wars in the first decades of the 20th century. The past eight decades of peace have been the exception, not the rule. So, too, the steady expansion of democratic government across the continent since World War II, and not just in the defeated powers, Nazi Germany and Fascist Italy. Portugal itself was governed for decades by the dictator Antonio de Oliveira Salazar and his feared secret police, the PIDE. It was only in 1974 that a group of young military officers, politicized by the army's war against pro-independent insurgents in Angola and Mozambique, staged a coup d'etat. It was nearly bloodless. The half-dozen casualties came from PIDE gunfire. Yet the political aftermath was messy, as I well recall from covering it as a young reporter. There were a series of attempted mini-coups as leftists and more moderate officers vied to set the political agenda. An army general, Antonio Romualdo Ins, led the moderates' decisive takeover in late 1975, setting the stage for elections and democratic government. The country led by Mr. Salazar was poorer and less developed than most other European countries. Yet democratic Portugal was also transformed economically, joining the European Economic Community, the precursor of today's 27-nation European Union, in the 1980s. It's perhaps little wonder that despite the genuine grievances on which Chega has built its growing influence, including housing affordability, public services, and immigration, most Portuguese voters still seem to prioritize a stable democratic government. Nor is it surprising that Chega has been drawing much of its support from young Portuguese, for whom the dictatorship and the early months of the transition to democracy are mere pages in the history book. Chega might yet further widen its base of support. In Italy, Giorgia Meloni, a right-wing politician with roots among post-war supporters of fascist leader Benito Mussolini, has transformed herself into a prime minister working effectively within the country's institutions and the EU. In France, Marine Le Pen's National Rally Party, heir to the National Front, headed by her father, a Holocaust denier, has long been hoping to chart a similar path. Yet the effect of Mr. Trump's support for such parties as vanguards in a grand civilizational struggle for Europe's future remains unclear. In Portugal, certainly most voters seem leery of the anger and potential instability that scenarios suggest. And Mr. Trump's truculent approach to Europe in recent weeks, his push to take over Greenland, and his inaccurate suggestion that European NATO troops supporting the United States in Afghanistan had stayed back from the front lines have not gone down well among Europeans. He has not only angered centrist politicians, he has unsettled political soulmates. A range of voices on the far right, including the National Rally, Britain's Reform UK, and even Prime Minister Meloni have criticized him. And that could be partly due to what the opinion polls are saying. The number of voters across Europe who like the American president is small, and it's getting smaller. So, while the Trump effect could add impetus to their own version of MAGA nationalism, they will worry, and center ground leaders will be hoping, it may tarnish their appeal with the voters they're striving to attract. And again, this particular article was by Ned Temko, who is a columnist at The Monitor. Still in the world section of today's Monitor, the next headline reads, a Ukrainian athlete wanted to honor fallen countrymen. The IOC said no. Winter Olympics skeleton athlete Vladislav Haraskevich wanted to wear a helmet decorated with images of Ukrainian athletes and civilians killed during the Russian invasion. The IOC said it was a violation of its rules. The date on this article is February the 12th. It is by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at The Monitor. And the dateline is Milan, Italy. Ukrainian skeleton athlete Vladislav Haraskevich was determined to compete in a helmet that depicted fellow athletes and civilians killed during the Russian invasion of his country. The International Olympic Committee was desperate for him to find another way of expressing his grief. In the end, Mr. Haraskevich would not be dissuaded, so his accreditation to compete in the 2026 Milan Cortina Olympics was withdrawn on Thursday morning, shortly before his first run. The IOC says the helmet violates its rules, which prohibit athletes from engaging in messaging on the field of play, in the Olympic Village, or doing medal ceremonies. Mr. Haraskevich said he is considering appealing the decision to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. So why did the IOC take such a strong stand? The IOC repeatedly insisted that it had no issue with Mr. Haraskevich's message, only where and when he intended to express it. The IOC is adamant that the field of play during competitions be kept free of any sort of messaging. Partly, the IOC is concerned about a slippery slope toward chaos. There are 130 conflicts going on in the world. We cannot have 130 different conflicts featured, however terrible they are, during the field of play during the actual competition, IOC spokesperson Mark Adams said during a news conference. One concern is that messaging could crowd out the actual sport, with athletes using the field of play to promote countless causes during the sporting events. But there is also concern that such messages could draw the IOC into various conflicts, threatening its desire to remain neutral. As a sporting organization, once we start taking stands against wars and conflicts, there is no end, Mr. Adams said Thursday. If we start reflecting all those conflicts in the world on the sporting field, there will be no sport. Athletes also desire to keep the field of play pure. The IOC rules came from a commission created in 2021 that included more than 3,500 athletes. To many, they are a protection. We also have to consider, with some countries, the pressure that is put on athletes to express views they may not necessarily agree with, Mr. Adams said. So has the IOC enforced its rules consistently? Mr. Harashevsky suggests the IOC is treating him unfairly. He cites American figure skater Maxim Naumov, who held up a picture of his late parents after his performance in the men's short program Tuesday. His parents died in a January 2025 plane crash. Mr. Harashevsky calls his helmet a helmet of remembrance. Other recent examples include an Israeli judoka, Peter Palchik, who appeared to kiss a military flag as he celebrated a medal during the 2024 Paris Olympics, and a German field hockey player, Nike Lorenz, who competed at the 2021 Tokyo Games wearing a rainbow band around her ankle in support of LGBTQ+ people around the world. None were officially sanctioned. A U.S. figure skater and others didn't face the same things, Mr. Harashevsky said at a Thursday morning news conference. So suddenly, just a Ukrainian athlete in this Olympic Games will be disqualified for this helmet, which is not violating any rules. The IOC has drawn a distinction between Mr. Naumov's show of grief and Mr. Harashevsky's saying the crucial difference is that Mr. Nomov waited until he left the field of play. They said Mr. Harashevsky was welcome to do the same. Ms. Lawrence received approval for her rainbow ankle band, but critics more generally say that efforts at neutrality tend to reinforce inequalities faced by minorities and marginalized people. The ability to stay neutral in times of oppression is an expression of privilege that is granted only to those in whose image the games were created, said a U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee's Council on Racial and Social Justice in 2021. There also appears to be an element of acting first and asking permission later. In the case of the Israeli judoka, the IOC did contact the Israeli Olympics Committee afterward to register its concern. By contrast with Mr. Harashevsky, it was the clear intention of him to do it. We asked him not to do it. We gave him alternatives, and he still carried on, Mr. Adams said on Thursday. So what was done to try to avoid this outcome? The IOC told Mr. Harashevsky numerous times, in person and by written warning, that his helmet was in violation of the rules for athletic expression, and he would not be allowed to race in it. That culminated with the president of the IOC, Kirsty Coventry, meeting with Mr. Harashevsky at 7:30 a.m. on Thursday, 2 hours before the start of the race. Ms. Coventry, a former Olympic swimmer from Zimbabwe and chair of the Athletes Commission that devised the new rules, said Mr. Harashevsky could carry his helmet after the race, as he did media interviews. He was also offered the opportunity to wear a black armband during the race, a widely recognized gesture of mourning in sports. Sadly, we're not able to come to that solution. I really wanted to see him race today. It's been an emotional morning, she said after the meeting. Mr. Harashevsky felt the emotion, too. Hard to put into words, he said. Emptiness, some kind of... He said he hoped television channels in their coverage of the event would honor the men and women on his helmet by showing pictures of him during his training runs, during which he was allowed to wear the helmet. I believe they deserve this moment, Mr. Harashevsky said. And again, this particular article is by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at The Monitor. Continuing on the Olympic theme, from the world section of today's Monitor, our next headline reads, Jordan Stolz and the near impossible task of being the next Eric Heiden. America has looked for its next Winter Olympic superstar since Eric Heiden won 5 gold medals in 1980. Jordan Stolz started his 2026 Winter Olympics Wednesday with an Olympic speed skating record. The date on this article is February the 12th. It is also by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at The Monitor, and the dateline is Milan. The search for the next Eric Heiden has not been kind to America's winter Olympians. Admittedly, the task is a massively unfair one. Mr. Heiden's performance in the 1980 Lake Placid Games remains one of the most remarkable feats in Olympic history, winning all 5 speed skating events with 4 Olympic records and 1 world record. But even by a lower bar, Americans have struggled since, from Bodie Miller to Dan Jansen to Michaela Schifrin. Several Americans have appeared reasonably poised for 3 or more gold medals. None have succeeded. Often their failures have been of the spectacular variety. On Wednesday, speed skater Jordan Stolz took a first confident step towards fulfilling that promise. He won the 1,000 meters in Olympic record time with Mr. Heiden watching from the stands, and Snoop Dogg too. But when isn't he watching? That, unfortunately, was the easy part. The 1,000 meters is Mr. Stoll's best race, yet as recently as 2024, he finished first in the 500, 1,000, and 1,500 meters at the World Championships. Last year, he finished with 2 silvers, 500 and 1,500 meters, and a bronze at 1,000 meters. There's also the possibility of gold in the mass start event at these Olympics, but the chaos of that race makes it chronically unpredictable. Mr. Stolz has admitted that everything needs to go perfectly for a chance at 3 or even 4 gold medals, but as he said Wednesday, now I've got one, and after the crashes and disappointments of previous would-be Haydns, it has kept that dream alive. Mr. Stolz has never shied away from the challenge, even as he has been realistic. But that's the thing. If there is a temperament for this sort of endeavor, Mr. Stolz seems to have it. Were NBC to put one of its heart monitors on him, it might struggle to register a reading. Yes, yes, he is calm. Yes, his monotone is as flat as a freshly zambonied ice sheet. But more than those things, he seems to have the rare gift of not overcomplicating things. When a journalist in a post-race press conference marveled at how none of the pressure seemed to be getting to him, Mr. Stolz deadpanned, "It's repetition. Winning 1,000 meters is not something I don't know how to do. Wake up, eat lunch, go to the rink, win Olympic medal. Simple." Jenning de Boo, the spectacularly named Dutch silver medalist, blew out to an early lead in the race, enough to make Mr. Stolz admit he was a little nervous. "But in the last turn, I heard him coming," Mr. de Boo said after the race. "You can hear his skates coming, and it's pretty creepy," he smiled. Asked how it feels to have someone catch you from behind, Mr. de Boo cracked another grin. "He's the only one who can do it," he said of Mr. Stolz. "His last lap is just incredible," Mr. de Boo enthused. How did Mr. Stolz do it? Here was his analysis. He didn't want to finish second, so he tried harder. You'd think everyone would give that strategy a go. At a media event in October, Mr. Stolz gave away a little more. He spoke of his work on the ice and off the ice on a bicycle during the summer. He spoke of being meticulous about every piece of equipment. "Seeing the work you put in off the ice, you can see that in your results," he said. He saw it in those last 200 meters Wednesday when silver became gold. The path ahead for Mr. Stolz is one trodden by only one other American Winter Olympian in history, Eric Haydn. No one else has ever won more than 2 gold medals in a winter game. Only 5 other Americans have ever won 3 medals of any color at a single Winter Olympics, and none of them won more than 1 gold. No one but Mr. Haydn has ever won 4 medals. The problem is not all, or even primarily, to do with American underperformance. It is related to which sports America is good at. Alpine skiing and speed skating offer multiple medals, but athletes generally specialize in those sports, making it almost impossible to medal across all the disciplines. By contrast, it's comparatively easier to medal in multiple events in cross-country and biathlon, both events in which America is historically weak. Norway has had 11 Winter Olympians win at least 4 medals in a single game. 10 have been cross-country skiers or biathletes. By contrast, America has 48 Summer Olympians who have won at least 4 medals in a single game, mostly in track and field, swimming, and gymnastics. And then, of course, there is Eric Haydn. That's the enormity of the challenge facing Mr. Stolz. For inspiration, he can turn to Swiss alpine skier Franjo von Ullmann, who won his 3rd gold of this game in the Super-G Wednesday. He is only the 4th alpine skier ever to do it. For Mr. Stolz, next is the 500 meters on Saturday with the 1,500 meters next Thursday. At the Olympic media event, Mr. Stolz's monotone broke for just one moment. Sometimes in the 1,500 meters, he said, "I'll start slow and catch up in the end." A smile peeked through. That's always fun. For the rest of the speed skating field, that is creepy. But for an American long awaiting its next Haydn, it is the sound of hope. And again, this particular article was written by Mark Sappenfield, who is a senior global correspondent at The Monitor. With that, we're going to move on to the USA section of today's Monitor and pick a few headlines from there. Our first headline from the USA section reads, "Is Trump's Teflon fading? Amid slumping polls, the president faces new pushback." Recent votes on tariffs and blunt public criticism signal a GOP that's more willing to defy President Donald Trump and worried about this fall's midterm elections. The date on this article is February 13th. It is by Linda Feldman, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. The dateline is Washington, D.C. 1 year ago, President Donald Trump seemed like an unstoppable juggernaut, radically upending both Washington and the international order as he aggressively bent both opponents and allies to his will. But there are gravitational forces in politics that it seems even President Trump can't overcome. His job approval ratings, which were above 50% a year ago, have slid steadily downward, now hovering in the low 40s. And lately, the president has encountered notable pushback, including from Congress, amid growing GOP concerns about a midterm blue wave. He has even made a few quiet un-Trump-like retreats. On Thursday, Borders Czar Tom Homan announced that the administration was ending its deployment of immigration agents in Minnesota after a two-month siege that led to violent clashes with protesters and resulted in federal agents shooting and killing two U.S. citizens. The move followed a similar drawdown in Maine. Last month, the administration also withdrew federalized National Guard troops from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Portland, a move made with little public acknowledgement other than a social media post from the president. The withdrawal came after a series of court rulings against the deployments, which had been met with sharp resistance from those Democratic-run cities. Mr. Trump claimed the troops had been needed to combat crime, and he said he might send them in again should crime rates go back up. This week, Mr. Trump's Justice Department received a remarkable rebuke when prosecutors failed to secure a grand jury indictment of six congressional Democrats who had posted a video reminding members of the military and the intelligence community that they had a constitutional duty to defy illegal orders. And the Republican head of the National Governors Association said the bipartisan group would not attend a White House meeting because the administration was planning to exclude Democratic governors. Mr. Trump put out a response on Thursday saying that the Democrats had in fact been invited, with the exception of two. In many ways, Mr. Trump is following a historical pattern. Presidents often take office amid grandiose promises and high expectations, but eventually encounter both the limits of their power and the inevitable swing of the political pendulum. Gallup polls going back to Harry S. Truman show a consistent first-year presidential slide. Since the Civil War, the president's party has almost always lost House seats in the midterms, including Mr. Trump's net loss of 40 seats in the 2018 election during his first term. Current polls suggest this November could be worse. The only real question right now, says pollster Charles Franklin of Marquette University Law School, is how great the damage will be. With slim majorities in Congress, especially the House, Republicans have little margin for error. Some House Republicans already seem to be shifting their plans, with a significant number, 30 so far, opting not to run again. That does not include those who have already left Washington, such as former Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a once-strong Trump ally who resigned last month after a falling out with the president. To be sure, Mr. Trump's hardcore MAGA base is still with him. It is soft supporters, some mainstream Republicans and right-leaning independents, who have been souring on him, polling experts say. The economy and immigration have been particularly weak spots for the president, with net approval on both dipping to second-term lows, according to the latest Economist YouGov poll. Perhaps most stinging of all, three recent polls, including some from pollsters that lean conservative, Harvard Caps Harris, Rasmussen, and Economist YouGov, find voters now say that former President Joe Biden did a better job than his successor, Mr. Trump. But Democrats shouldn't be overconfident. The Real Clear Politics poll average shows their party's favorability at just 36%. Notably, GOP lawmakers have begun pushing back against some of Mr. Trump's more controversial policies after moving in lockstep with his administration for much of last year. On Wednesday, the House voted to rescind U.S. tariffs on Canada, with six Republicans joining almost all Democrats. The measure, a similar version of which has already passed the Senate, is largely symbolic. Mr. Trump is expected to veto it. But its passage still matters, reflecting the strongest effort yet by Congress to reassert its power on trade policy. More tariff votes are expected in the days and weeks to come. Late last year, Congress defied initial opposition from the president to push through legislation mandating the release of documents related to Jeffrey Epstein, the late financier and convicted sex offender who was at one point a Trump friend, though Mr. Trump maintains that they had a falling out years before Mr. Epstein's crimes became publicly known. The drip, drip, drip of information from those files, which include references to many notable figures in the Trump orbit, has kept the administration on defense. There's also a subtle shift in tone from some Republican lawmakers. GOP members have been quicker to offer criticism of Trump policies. Senator Katie Britt of Alabama, for example, expressed concern over an Ecuadorian boy in a bunny hat detained by U.S. immigration authorities in Minnesota. Many Republicans strongly rebuked Mr. Trump's post on social media last weekend of a video that included a depiction of the Obamas as apes. The Senate's only black Republican, Tim Scott, called it racist, and several GOP lawmakers called on the president to apologize. He did not apologize, but Mr. Trump eventually took down the post, which the administration blamed on a staffer. Such moments of defiance, while more frequent, remain unusual. Many of those speaking out are either not up for re-election this fall, like Senator Britt, or are already planning to retire. For those on the ballot, displeasing the president can still invite peril. In some cases, Mr. Trump is backing or openly considering backing primary opponents to congressional Republicans he sees as disloyal or weak. He has the Republican Party still firmly within his grasp, says John Kenneth White, a presidential historian and emeritus professor at Catholic University. The thing that GOP members fear most is an angry tweet. Yet with Republicans needing to hold every seat to protect their majority, Mr. Trump's threats against vulnerable members from swing districts, such as those voting to repeal the tariffs on Canada, may carry increasingly less weight, or come across as a form of self-sabotage. Mr. Trump may be nearing lame duck status, the eventual plight of every second-term U.S. president, but he and his team aren't taking it lying down. On Tuesday, Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt presented reporters with a list of wins that she complained they weren't asking about. The Dow Jones Industrial Average hitting a record high, two major medical groups endorsing restrictions on youth gender reassignment, a federal appeals court upholding the Trump immigration detention policy, and the U.S. murder rate hitting a 125-year low. Then Wednesday brought a better-than-expected jobs report. Unemployment in January fell to 4.3%, down from 4.4% a month before, with 130,000 jobs created. Mr. Trump and company shouted the numbers from the rooftop. Whether that will make a difference with voters remains to be seen. Last month, the White House said the president would begin weekly campaign-style trips to tout his record on the economy and how he was working to bring prices down. That travel schedule already seems to have fallen off. Even those speeches have not always gone smoothly. At a visit to a Ford plant in Michigan last month, Mr. Trump was heckled by a worker over his connection to Mr. Epstein. The president, who appeared ruffled, mouthed an expletive and told the worker, "You're fired." This week, news outlets reported that the worker has, in fact, kept his job. And again, this particular article is by Linda Feldman, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Moving on to our second headline from today's USA section of the Monitor. This one reads, with trust in U.S. wavering, NATO allies meet in Brussels and Munich to forge new ties. At meetings this week, NATO officials and European allies grapple with the Trump-driven reality that they must now take charge of their own defense. The date on this article is February the 13th. It is by Anna Mulreen Grobe, who is a staff writer at the Monitor, and the dateline is Brussels. At the entrance to NATO headquarters, a mangled steel beam from the 107th floor of the World Trade Center's North Tower memorializes the 9/11 attack on the United States. An accompanying plaque notes that within 24 hours, NATO had invoked the alliance's mutual defense clause for the first time in its history, going to war on behalf of the U.S. But at a gathering for top NATO defense officials here this week, messages of transatlantic unity were muted as European allies come to terms with the Trump-driven reality that they must now take charge of their own defense. In Brussels earlier this week, there was lots of talk of stepping up as America's NATO allies detailed moves to increase the supply of weapons, untangle logistical knots, and bring more bullets and missiles to Ukraine's battlefield. These efforts are bearing fruit. Though the U.S. has almost completely withdrawn direct aid to Ukraine, Europe has come together to fill the gap, according to a report released Wednesday from the Kiel Institute for the World Economy. NATO officials also announced a new mission to beef up security in the Arctic, a move widely seen as a way to appease President Donald Trump's demands for control of Greenland, given his reluctance to rule out using military force to get it. Basically, it's important that we collectively understand that Mr. Trump has a big point here, NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte said at a press briefing here Wednesday. Mr. Rutte has praised President Trump as the catalyst who has forced NATO members to boost their defense budget contributions to meet or exceed the 2% GDP target and commit to 5% by 2035. Despite cooperative appearances, underlying alliance tensions are expected to follow U.S. and European defense officials to Friday's Munich Security Conference, where top Democrats like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez hope to reassure European allies that Mr. Trump's opponents see a more effective and collaborative way forward. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is leading a large delegation and is expected to adopt a more collaborative tone while still defending administration policies. Still, there's a prevailing mood within the alliance that some security analysts liken to a married couple coming to terms with the fact that your partner may not love you anymore, says Natalie Tocci, a professor at Johns Hopkins University of Advanced International Studies in Europe. Some NATO members are grappling with trust issues, she adds. She and others tick off President Trump's red carpet reception of Russian President Vladimir Putin in Alaska last summer. Mr. Trump's comments minimizing the contributions of NATO allies fighting in Afghanistan, setting off protests last month in Denmark, which had the highest per capita casualty rate of any of America's NATO allies there, and his Oval Office berating of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky 1 year ago. The time will come to reconstitute a different, healthier relationship, adds Professor Tocci, who has also served as a special advisor to two European Union high representatives for foreign policy. But you probably need a moment of distance before you can become good friends again, she said. Against this backdrop, Secretary General Rutte was asked Wednesday if U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's absence from this week's NATO meeting of defense ministers with Elbridge Colby, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, attending instead, signals a decline in the U.S. commitment to the alliance. Mr. Colby was a telling choice, as the proxy, some analysts say. He has argued that, quote, we have to choose Asia while prioritizing U.S. military resources because of the threat from China. It's a policy outlook embodied in America's new National Defense Strategy's assessment of Russia as a persistent but manageable threat to NATO's eastern members. The report notably did not characterize Moscow as a threat to the U.S. or to the alliance writ large, analysts pointed out. Mr. Ruta welcomed Mr. Colby to NATO headquarters on Thursday with the sort of rhetorical largesse that has earned him the sobriquet Trump Whisper within the alliance. The Defense Undersecretary has been a consistent force over the years for Europe and Canada to really step up when it comes to defense spending, Mr. Ruta said. The U.S., while a stalwart NATO ally, also has to take care of the situation in the Pacific, he added. Mr. Colby, for his part, lauded the flexible realism of his administration's new national defense strategy for its insistence on an alliance based on partnership rather than dependency, and a Europe that leads NATO's conventional defense. The U.S. will continue to provide for Europe under its umbrella of nuclear deterrence, he added. The prospect of Russian forces inching closer to American territory does, however, get the Trump administration's attention. This was part of the logic behind the Wednesday launch of Arctic Sentry, a NATO military officer said on condition of anonymity. The mission will bring regional drills under a single NATO command to counter Russian and Chinese influence in what NATO officials called one of the world's most strategically significant regions. If Russian submarines pass undetected through the naval choke point formed by the islands of Britain, Iceland, and Greenland, known as the GIUK Gap, and into the deep, open Atlantic, they become much harder to detect. It becomes very difficult to track those submarines out there, the NATO military officer added. Those submarines then pose a very existential threat to the United States and also to NATO because we're talking about nuclear-capable vessels. Others view the new Arctic mission merely as a rebranding of NATO's existing security work in the region. Some reporters pointed out that studies show no Chinese ships lurking near Greenland. NATO officials countered that there soon could be, given the rate at which Arctic ice is melting. For now, despite alliance tensions, NATO officials highlight how quickly European members are stepping up to fill the security gap on the continent as the U.S. steps back. By 2029, for example, Germany will spend $180 billion on defense, more than double what it spent in 2021, Mr. Ruta pointed out Wednesday, adding that it is one example among many. He also touted this week's transfer of two top NATO commands from American to European officers and lauded NATO's newest fund for providing weapons to Kyiv in its fight against Russia's invasion 4 years ago this month. Launched after a July meeting between Mr. Ruta and Mr. Trump, the Prioritized Ukraine Requirements List, PEARL, encouraged allies to buy weapons from the U.S. for Ukraine. These weapons are still in short supply as Kyiv comes under increasing fire from Moscow and struggles with desertions among exhausted troops. Russia launched 55,000 drone attacks against Ukraine in 2025, a five-fold increase from the previous year, according to a senior NATO official who offered background on condition of anonymity. The official added Wednesday that civilian casualties in Ukraine are up 30% over 2024. Still, while some two-thirds of NATO's 32 members have committed to join PEARL, others are holding back, a decision that reflects not just budgetary concerns, but also tensions in the transatlantic relationship, analysts say. France has not contributed to the fund, arguing that it cannot justify using French taxpayer dollars to buy American weapons while also pushing for Europe's strategic autonomy, notes a Chatham House report. Such concerns come amid speculation by some European diplomats and NATO officials that the U.S. may be downsizing its troop levels in Europe, which have hovered between 75,000 and 105,000 since 2022. The U.S. president last week signaled that those levels would remain steady. Still, the transatlantic relationship remains unlikely to return to the historic status quo, many analysts say, even after the Trump administration ends. We know the old order, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney warned this last month, is not coming back. And again, this particular article was by Anna Mulring Grobe, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Alrighty, here's one more headline from today's USA section of the Monitor on a different but, much talked about subject. The headline reads, A Guide to the Epstein Files. Will any new charges result? The release of documents surrounding sex offender Jeffrey Epstein has stirred massive media attention, but much of the evidence is inconclusive. The challenge is sifting facts from a frenzy of speculation. The date on this article is February the 12th. It is by Henry Gath, Cameron Pugh, and Victoria Hoffman, all of whom are staff writers at the Monitor. The recent release of more than 3 million pages of documents related to criminal investigations into Jeffrey Epstein is shedding new light on the elite network surrounding the disgraced financier and convicted sex offender and raising questions about whether new prosecutions will emerge. News organizations and private citizens alike are continuing to uncover new information from the massive document dump, despite redactions that have left a complete picture elusive. Mr. Epstein, who died in jail in 2019 in what was officially ruled a suicide, is alleged to have run a sex trafficking ring catering not just to himself, but also potentially to some of the world's most powerful people. More than 1,000 survivors of his alleged crimes have been identified since investigations into Mr. Epstein began in the mid-2000s. The only person to have been sentenced to prison for Epstein-related crimes is Ghislaine Maxwell, his longtime associate, who is serving a 20-year sentence for her role alongside Mr. Epstein in sex trafficking operations. Some prominent individuals have faced reputational and employment consequences because of revelations in the file. Donald Trump makes frequent appearances in the Epstein files, though this doesn't prove any wrongdoing. Both he and Mr. Epstein own homes in Palm Beach, Florida, and socialized together in the 1980s and 90s. President Trump has said the pair fell out in the early 2000s. According to Democratic Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland, Mr. Trump's name appeared more than 1 million times in a search of the unredacted files. So, how the Epstein files became public. Demand for the full release of the Epstein files grew in recent years from survivors and lawmakers in both parties. Congress passed legislation this past November forcing the Justice Department to begin releasing files in January. The department had argued against a full release, citing privacy concerns for survivors and unindicted third parties. Critics say the recent release still falls short, pointing to heavy redactions and the notable absence of certain Trump administration officials, including Attorney General Pam Bondi and FBI Director Kash Patel. The release has also been accompanied by a spike in unverified and false allegations on social media, often stemming from misinterpretations of emails or AI-generated fakes. In many ways, instead of providing clarity and transparency, the Epstein files release appeared to have deepened public mistrust of government and further fanned the flames of conspiracy. So is there anything incriminating in the new files? The Epstein files include documents from 3 federal investigations of Mr. Epstein, documents that courts have kept mostly sealed since the early 2000s. The mystery and suspicion surrounding their content, in particular the possibility that he had rich and powerful co-conspirators, have fueled conspiracy theories for years. The 2 co-sponsors of the Epstein File Transparency Act, Republican Thomas Massie of Kentucky and Democratic Representative Ro Khanna of California, have said that unredacted versions of the files reveal 6 new, likely incriminated men. Why the files are mistrusted? Survivors and members of Congress have criticized the Justice Department for what they describe as heavy-handed redactions of the files. One group of survivors described the redactions as abnormal and extreme. A watchdog group has complained to the Department of Justice that the files are missing communications between Trump officials at the DOJ. The favorable plea deal federal prosecutors gave Mr. Epstein back in 2008, his extensive connections to men in positions of power, the unusual circumstances surrounding his death, and the heavily redacted nature of the publicly released files have collectively reinforced a widespread mistrust in the federal government's handling of the case. Are powerful people being protected? Was there a cover-up? so why prosecution is difficult. Some legal experts say that if the files contained evidence strong enough to bring new criminal charges, those charges likely would have been filed already. Indeed, an unsigned memo from the Justice Department and the FBI last year said as much. After an exhaustive and systematic internal review, the memo said, the agencies did not uncover evidence that could predicate an investigation against uncharged third parties. There was no incriminating client list and no credible evidence that Mr. Epstein had blackmailed prominent individuals. Even if incriminating evidence is uncovered, successful prosecutions could still be a challenge. Sexual assault cases are notoriously difficult to prosecute at the best of times. In the Epstein case, concerning potentially decades-old events, it becomes even harder and might be impossible if the statute of limitation forecloses certain new criminal charges. Democrats in Congress are pushing a bill to eliminate the statute of limitation for adult victims of sex trafficking to file civil lawsuits. The Trump administration last year said there won't be additional prosecution, said David Arenberg, who served as state attorney for Palm Beach County in Florida from 2013 to 2025. The delay makes it so much harder, he added. Memories fade, witnesses die, evidence spoils. It's very difficult to prosecute a case based on evidence from years ago. Next topic, Ms. Maxwell remains a wild card. Her 2011 trial provided more detail of her role in Mr. Epstein's activities, but because it focused on her crimes alone, it said nothing about other potential co-conspirators. The possibility that she knows more than she has been forced to reveal has hung in the air ever since. A prison interview with Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche in July 2025 resulted in her transfer to a minimum security prison. In a congressional hearing on February 9th, she invoked the Fifth Amendment and refused to answer any questions. She would talk, her lawyer said, if President Trump granted her clemency. So what investigations got us here? First, federal investigation. Mr. Epstein's legal troubles began in 2005 when the parents of a 14-year-old girl in Palm Beach, Florida, went to local police and said the wealthy financier had molested her. After investigating, local law enforcement uncovered a dozen more victims dating back years. Local police eventually forwarded their findings to federal prosecutors. The federal investigation resulted in an unusually lenient 2008 plea deal that saw Mr. Epstein convicted of one count of solicitation of a prostitute, but kept the investigation's finding under seal. Alex Acosta, who negotiated the pre-deal as a U.S. attorney, later became labor secretary during Mr. Trump's first term. He resigned that post as a new Epstein investigation drew attention to the plea deal. The plea deal immunized Mr. Epstein and any potential co-conspirators from all future federal criminal charges. Okay, so second, how about the federal investigation? Another federal investigation into Mr. Epstein began in 2019. The immunization deal was binding only in southern Florida. He was arrested and charged that year on one count of sex trafficking of minors and one count of conspiracy, but he died in jail just before the case went to trial. The third federal investigation. In 2020, federal prosecutors charged Ms. Maxwell with sex trafficking of a minor and related crimes in Mr. Epstein's enterprise. She was convicted in 2021 and is currently serving a 20-year prison sentence. To date, no one else has been criminally prosecuted in relation to Mr. Epstein's illegal activities. With that, I'm afraid we have run out of time, so there is a little more to this particular article, but we'll have to stop there. As always, I appreciate you spending some of your valuable time with me, listening to a variety of articles from the Christian Science Monitor. Stay safe, stay well, stay hopeful, and I'll be back with more for you from the Christian Science Monitor next week. Thank you for listening.